because insurance is the backbone of it. And as long as insurance is the backbone of that statute, the defense issue is part and parcel and will automatically be triggered if and only if there is a legal indemnity obligation that can also be triggered at the end of the case, as Representative Hortman pointed out. So I just would like to make sure that everybody understands that I actually believe you will have less certainty and more litigation if you have two sections in the same statute that are conflicting with each other. Thank you for your time.
You just raised a whole other thing. Did you say the defense obligation will only be triggered if there's a legal indemnity that is there? So it, that if the indemnity provision is void as against public policy, then the defense obligation is not triggered?
Mr. Chair, excuse me. What I'm saying is that you can't get the defense unless there is the potential for the indemnity that's allowed by law, which is it has to be related to your work. The person that's providing the insurance, the claim has to be related, in Representative Hortman's example, to the concrete. It can't be the plumber did something wrong and the general says, you're going to defend me or you're going to indemnify me. If there's no way to get indemnity from that sub, you can't get the defense from that sub. That's what I'm saying. And that's what the statute corrected with respect to indemnification. You can only indemnify.
You're talking about the indemnity for vicarious liability.
Correct.
Correct. Because that's not what these contracts are saying.
Well, again, I don't have all the contracts available. The contracts that I've read have an indemnification provision that talks about vicarious or warranty liability, basically almost track the statute word for word. So I can't speak to the others.
Your members aren't all using the same contract.
Their contract is in here if he wants to see his.
Well, we can provide you with a copy of what Senator Jensen has. Let's have the subs come in. Go ahead and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Nick McNeely. I'm a contract lobbyist with the Minnesota Subcontractors Association, and I guess I would just like to briefly testify about any agreements. And I believe I was part of all negotiations on this bill, and I can tell you very clearly that I was never part of any negotiation discussing or separating the duty to defend from the duty to indemnify. If you have any more questions about that, please feel free to ask me.
Well, the language that is in the bill that was passed last year just refers to insurance coverage for negligence or intentional acts or omissions, which would be an indemnification related. Just on the language itself, are you suggesting that that also was intended to include, or you thought it also included, the duty to defend and not just indemnify?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I believe I, along with the 17 to 20 other associations, and I don't mean to speak for all of them, a number of them are here today, though, believed that that was the defense and the indemnity were included and dealt with in this legislation.
Any questions from Mr. McNeely? All right.
Thank you very much for your time.
Anyone else wish to comment and testify? All right, what's the will of the conference? Well, Senator Hall is going to be back in just a moment. I understand he had to take care of another matter. Well, what's the will of the conference committee? Any further discussion among members of the conference committee? Is there any possibility of resolving this, creating a meeting of the minds between the subcontractors and the contractors, the generals, on the matter of the Jensen provision?
Senator Jensen, the only thing that I can think of is that the contracts would be more explicit towards vicarious liability, as he stated, rather than any liability at all. Because that's what caused the problem, is that the contracts changed. And when the contracts changed and included and separated out defense from indemnity and something else, is what put it back to where the subcontractors are going to have to buy insurance to, in order to do that, and back into the same position they were in before, no matter what kind of deal. I mean, that is the problem, that nobody knows for sure how that's going to work, and the courts are not, I mean, I'm not sure what the courts will do, but I think there are going to be people that will not have enough liability insurance to cover somebody else and themselves. Because the way it was before, that was for themselves. They were just taking on the negligence themselves, so they were covered themselves. Now, this moves it so that they have to do it for somebody else, which was never the case before. So the contract changes have caused this problem. And when I read, I haven't seen one that is like what he referenced. They all say contracts, all claims. No matter what the end result is, no matter what negligence, no matter, you will do, all of it is in here on these contracts.
So, Senator Jensen, what you're saying is that the contracts provide that the subcontractors will defend the general contractor against claims of negligence on the part of the general contractor.
Correct.
Even if the statute provides it in the end, if the general contractor is found to be negligent, the subs won't have, insurance won't have to pay, indemnify,
right,
or pay for that negligence. But they're still obligated under the contract,
yes,
that you have to pay for the defense of claims that the generals were negligent.
Yes, that's correct.
So it's not only vicarious liability that you're saying. The way the contracts are reading is the generals are getting defense costs paid when the claim against the general is that the general was negligent.
Correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Horton.
Well, I think a court, though, interpreting these contracts, if you have in this hypothetical situation where the court ultimately finds that the general was responsible or some other sub was responsible, under state law, we have said that the subs don't have to be responsible for providing insurance coverage for other people's negligence. I don't know why that wouldn't extend to coverability of the duty to defend.
Well, that's the question here, because the generals are putting terms in their contracts which are saying that the subs have the duty to defend, notwithstanding the language in the statute.
And the insurance company has to pay because of the language in the insurance
Senator
contract. Says if it's in the contract, they have to pay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Horton.
But the contracts are dealing with a period of time prior to the determination of liability. The statute is dealing with a point in time at which liability has been determined. And so there is, you know, as lawyers, we know our favorite period of time, the time between which a claim is made and any determination of liability is made. And if we were to accept the Jensen Amendment, we create this area of uncertainty of who's responsible for what during that time period. And that uncertainty, I think, is what the generals are addressing in their contract provisions.
Well, but what the generals are doing is they're shifting the obligation to pay the cost of defense even against claims that the generals themselves are negligent.
Mm-hmm.
Not just vicarious, but liability.
There might be somebody here who can answer your question.
Well, it seems to be what the contracts are
okay.
saying. I mean, I've read the same contract that Senator Jensen had out. Mr. Walensky, you want to state that?
Mr. Chair,
the case
if I could see
contracts?
The contract, I'd look
sure.
at it. Sure.
There's three different ones
sure.
in there.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, the members. What I was referring to with respect to the language that tracks with the statute that was passed
last session is right above where Senator Jensen was reading from this particular contract. And it talks about, to the fullest extent permitted by law, the subcontractor agrees to indemnify and save harmless the contractor from all claims arising out of the contractor's vicarious liability, warranty liability, strict liability, or other such similar liability for the subcontractor's acts or omissions. So that language, quite frankly, tracks, I think, almost word for word with the...
Okay, for paragraph D. Go on.
Correct. And then after that, it talks about the subcontractor will defend the contractor from all such claims.
All such claims?
Yeah, all claims which are defined within the contract. But
all
that,
claims.
Right. But that... That's where when you put in the to the fullest extent permitted by law in the indemnification provision, there wouldn't be a situation, if a court looked at it, there wouldn't be a situation where if the indemnity couldn't be triggered by the indemnification clause here, that you could also get the defense. Because the court would say the statute prohibits you from getting a defense if you couldn't ultimately get indemnification from that subcontractor. So, I mean, the language...
Where does the statute say that?
Well, the statute prohibits you from getting indemnification for things that aren't related to the subcontractor's work.
Where does the statute prohibit you getting a defense for that?
Well, the statute doesn't say that explicitly, and that's because it's an insurance provision. What I'm saying is the statute prohibits you from getting... In my example... If you had the concrete contractor who was, the allegation said the concrete was faulty, and if a general contractor tendered that and sued the plumber who had nothing to do with the concrete work, there would be no basis to get any indemnification under the law for the plumber's work. So by that basis, you could not get the defense from that plumber because there is no potential indemnification for the claim. It works. That's how insurance works. You have defense for arguably covered claims, but if there's no argument that it could be covered by the indemnification, you cannot get a defense, and no insurance company would have to provide that. And it would be the same for a subcontractor. If a general said to the plumber, this concrete guy messed up, I want you to defend me, the plumber would say no, and they'd be right under the law.
But that's not the way the contract reads. The contract says that all claims against the contract, it says here, shall defend the contractor from and against all claims, including, without limiting the generality of the foregoing, mm-hmm. the claims for which the contractor may be or may be claimed to be liable, whether or not the allegations are meritorious.
Right,
so
and that
would include defending claims against the contractor for the contractor's own negligence that the contractor is forcing the subcontractor's insurance to pay for. The defense of those claims. And you're telling me that that's somehow prohibited by the statute, but I don't see it prohibited anywhere. I see the indemnification is prohibited. I don't see anything in the statute that says the contractor can't shift the defense costs to the subcontractor, even for the contractor's own negligence defense.
Mr. Chair, if I may address that point. That is true, except for the fact that when you have... I'm sorry. No problem. To your point, that is true, but it only is with respect to a claim that the sub may have indemnity for. The point being, when a lawsuit started, many times there will be...
That's not what this contract says. I'm sorry, Mr. Polsky. That's not what this contract says. And there's nothing in the statute that prohibits that I can tell, unless you read the statute to more broadly include the defense, but it's not explicit in here. And so what it looks like to me is that the contractors may be taking advantage of an arguably ambiguous language in subdivision 1B to force the subcontractors to pay for their defense. And I mean, this is a really broad provision here. Maybe not what, you know, what Mortenson is providing to you, but someone's providing it forcing their subcontractors to pay for it and their insurance companies to pay for it. And that's the harm that we're trying to address in the Jensen Amendment. Now, whether it's artfully done in this provision or not is a separate question, perhaps. But to me, I think there's a moral question. Should the contractor be able to shift their cost of defense to the subcontractor when the claim is for the contractor's own negligence? I don't see anything prohibiting that explicitly in the statute.
Mr. Chair, if I may. The issue is, it's to track with insurance. I mean, in insurance, for instance, if you had someone sue you for slipping and falling on your sidewalk or what have you, the allegations may be that you did all kinds of things wrong and caused that injury. And you may say, I did nothing wrong. You just tripped. But your insurance company isn't going to care about whether you had some fault or whether someone else had some fault or whether there was no fault. They're going to defend you against that lawsuit regardless of what the ultimate fault may be, even if it is someone else's fault. And that's how insurance works. And this is no different. I mean, you say that there's taking advantage.
No, it's based on the insurance.
I beg to
differ, because this insurance here says that the other person, or the subcontractor, isn't going to be liable for negligence.
But
they're going to be liable for negligence because it's void as against public policy now under the language here. But they still got to defend.
But that's because it's all based on the ability to insure the indemnification. And if you had, for instance, a situation where you leased your property to a tenant, you would still be responsible for things that would occur on that property, even if your tenant did something wrong.
Okay, but what you're saying,
the issue is you should be defended.
Because it's insurable, it's okay for you to shift the burden to the subcontractor.
To the extent that the claim is directly related to their work for which we're vicariously liable.
No, I'm not talking about vicarious liability. I'm talking about direct liability. You still
no.
think it's okay to shift that cost of defense to the subcontractor?
No, and I do not believe that this contract or the law would allow that.
Well, it looks to me like the language of this contract here is sufficiently broad to cover. And I don't see anything in the law that explicitly prohibits that unless you read that defense language into paragraph 3, which is what Senator Jensen's attempting to clarify.
Yes, thank you.
That's the purpose anyway of Senator Jensen's bill. So I think on the merits, I think it's really hard for the contractors to justify shifting the cost to defense. I still come back to the second question. I'd love to see how much the premiums were reduced by the insurance companies to the subcontractors for taking out the indemnification obligation, or if they're still paying the same insurance premiums.
Well, I can tell you the cost of adding additional insured has definitely gone down, because that's a cost up front that they don't have to do it. So that is a savings to the subcontractors right up front. And your example, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but your example of somebody slipping and falling, that is your liability that you pay for, and that's what we've always asked for. What this would be is if your neighbor had somebody go on their step and fall, and you would be responsible for that liability. That's what we're trying to prevent. That's what we're trying to say is you purchase your insurance to protect you from your negligence, your liability, and your acts involving in that, which includes indemnification liability. Except for, and we understood, there are a few things, vicarious. And if this said that, there wouldn't be a need for the clarification either. It goes way beyond that and moves forward on making it be anything for any reason. And that's why the clarification is necessary.
Representative Horton.
Mr. Belinsky, did you write this contract?
I did.
This one we're looking at right here. Okay.
And the intent of that contract, and it is not written in a way that would allow us to get coverage or defense for our own sole negligence, but unfortunately, in the construction industry, there is always allegations when something goes wrong and someone sues the general contractor in every case, even if it's all because of the subcontractor's work being faultily installed or done, what have you. There's always allegations that the general contractor has some fault in that claim, even if they didn't lift a hammer to actually put the pipe or the concrete or whatever it is in. And so the reason it's drafted that way is because in insurance,
We get the defense, even if we are 1% at fault at the end of the day, we get a defense because the claim arose out of, was directly related to the subcontractor's work for which we're vicariously responsible by statute and by contract. And so that is the difference between a homeowner's, a neighbor, saying, you got to defend me for my problems on my property. There's no vicarious liability on that issue. But if the law in Minnesota was changed to say generals are not vicarious liable for their subs, we would have no problem saying that subcontractors, you're only responsible for your problems, we're only responsible for ours, never the two shall meet. But law in Minnesota says we are vicariously responsible for them. Okay. And owners require the same stuff from us as well.
Representative. Mr. Chair, I think in the real world, the way these things happen, we have to recognize that there is a point in time when whoever is filing the suit is going to name Mortenson, and they're going to name the concrete sub, and there's going to be a dispute, and there has to be a defense at that time. Now, if Mortenson's not doing anything, they're the contractor, they're hiring all the subs, you have to deal, either they have the duty to defend or the subs have the duty to defend. If they were going to negotiate on this point in last year's bill, I think they would have negotiated on this point. I think the agreement is silent. What the agreement addressed was the duty to indemnify. It didn't address the duty to defend. And that is a completely different part of the deal in a different insurable interest.
We're voting right now on the
Okay.
Senate.
Okay, I just real quick. The reason Senator that I Johnson, believe yeah. for myself is because 33701 just said indemnify or hold harmless, that we used that for what we worked on. It wasn't anything that was meant to be left out. It was because that's what was there, and contracts never separated it. So to me, as a legislator looking at it as public policy, there was no conversation about it, leaving it out or putting it in. I just went by what was in that current statute and then applying it based on the contracts that were currently out there that didn't include it. And what caused the problem is when the contracts changed.
But regardless of what was in the deal at this point, I think the question still remains. The example is vicarious liability, and Mr. Galinsky keeps coming back to that. I think the contract is written far more broadly than vicarious liability. All claims shall be defended, which would include claims for negligence by the contractor. And certainly if the complaint stated a claim that the contractor was somehow directly negligent in some way, it seems to me then the contractor ought to have the duty to at least partially cover the cost of defense relating to that component of it. But in this contract, that entire cost of defense has been shifted to the subcontractor. You know, if the only allegation of the complaint is vicarious liability under the statute, you know, that's covered by paragraph D, and that's already dealt with. But if there's an allegation of the complaint that somehow the contractor was directly negligent, then the contractor ought to share the cost of defense, in my judgment. And, you know, whether or not that's provided for in the law right now or not, I think the contractor ought to. So, but we're in the middle of a vote, okay. So we're going to have to come back. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Okay.
Up and moving.
Mr. Valensky wanted to put some comment on the record, and we're going to move forward only with committee deliberation. Mr. Valensky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real briefly, I just wanted to point out on that contract that we were discussing and your concern about claims being any claims on the project or that could even be the general contractor's fault. The term claims in that provision is defined right above it, and it is limited to claims that are arising out of resulting from the work provided for in the subcontract, so it has to be related to the subcontractor's work. And that term is then used down below in the provision that Senator Jensen was reading from. So the claims that we're talking about defense for is limited to arising out of the subcontractor's work. And it is further limited by the indemnification, which is for the vicarious strict liability or other warranty liability arising out of the acts or omissions of the subcontractor. So I just wanted to point that out. It's not our intent to have defense for solely our acts, and in fact, that would be, we're going to follow the statute. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Walensky. Committee. Senator Jensen?
Well, I'd like to move the Senate provision amended to take in force on, comma, or out. We need to see that. It was the issue that came up yesterday.
I've got the same. There was a question yesterday raised about the constitutionality of line 1.12, which applied the change retroactively to existing contracts that contradict the contracts clause of the Constitution. So Senator Jensen moves adoption of the Senate position, which includes both Section 1 and Section 2, in the Senate bill, with the change on line 1.12 of the Senate language, deleting in force, comma, or. So that's the motion before us. Is there any discussion or further discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Horton.
You know, we can just vote, because I think you know where I'm coming from based on my earlier comments, but we, with regard to design professionals, have worked very hard to reach agreement with all parties in the dispute. And for 5 years, we've been arguing with AGC to finally get to a stage where we could fix the design professionals' concerns. And I feel that it would be an act of bad faith on my part to do something that they don't agree with on a portion of my bill, when the other portion's really been worked through the process and we've reached consensus. And the other portion of House File 2090 doesn't affect subcontractors, and so I plan to vote that.
Is there any further discussion? All right. All those in favor of Senator Jensen's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Well, we have a divided room. I'm under the rules of the conference committee. We need to have a majority of each side. So the motion does not prevail. All right. Is there another motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move the House version of 2090 as it went to the Senate.
All right. Senator Hortman, Representative Hortman, moves the House language as the bill was formulated when it went to the Senate. Is there any further discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The motion is adopted. We have the House language, and that will be the report of the conference.
Thank you, Senator.
Important, and members, this conference committee is concluded and adjourned.
I won't be at all. I need it next year.